Okay, we will get started. Good morning, everyone. It's good to see all of you here. My name is Troy Swanson. I'm the library department chair. I'm very excited to welcome Jesse Sharkey to our library. Last year, as you may know, there was a big election in Chicago. The city of Chicago elected a new mayor who actually was a classroom teacher. And I remember fondly an editorial from the Chicago Tribune saying, and I took this as like a love letter, I think, to what was going on, calling the Chicago Teachers Union the new Chicago machine, which I thought was kind of funny because many of us were involved in that. And if you want to talk about a machine that was made up of moms with strollers, grandparents, union members, teachers knocking on doors to elect a mayor, that's what was going on. And if you want to call that the machine, I took that as a compliment. To make that happen is a long story that goes back over a decade that Jesse Sharkey and his partners were part of, transforming the Chicago Teachers Union from a union that focused in on just their members to something bigger. That really has been an example for many people in unions across the country. Recently, you may know, the United Auto Workers were on strike. When Sean Fain, the president of UAW, came to Chicago, he acknowledged the work of CTU and Karen Lewis as showing the way for a new modern relationship between communities and organized labor. Jesse and his partners have been good friends of us here at the college. We're part of the Cook County College Teachers Union. Our union president, Tony Johnson, is here. Thanks, Tony. And we've been good friends and partners with CTU for many years. So y'all students, you may not know, but your teachers are union members who are part of this ongoing conversation. So when I bumped into Jesse recently and he said, "Hey, I'm working on this book and he's got some good ideas about this history." And I was like, "You know what you should do? You should come to my library and give a talk." And you know what? I was so surprised he said yes. So after this long intro, I want to say thank you, Jesse, for being here today. And thank you to all of you for being in our audience. And I'll turn it over to Jesse.
Thank you all for having me. I'm Jesse Sharkey. I am a public school teacher in the city of Chicago. I started teaching there in 1998. I actually grew up in rural Maine, was a good student, and got a scholarship to a big university and found my way to Chicago and thought, I'll change the world by teaching students. And somehow along the way, I've come up against some of the limits of what you can do as a really dedicated individual, one student at a time. Got involved in some social movements, which were part of asking the question, well, how do we make our society better? Mostly for our students, that was our original concern, but then also, how do we defend public education and stop some of the attacks on the career, the work of teaching, the craft, if you will. And eventually, we were a group that became powerful enough to elect one of our own members to be the mayor of the city of Chicago, which I would argue has actually is both connected to a process of change, but also is significant for everyone in the state, and has some real insights in it, whether you live in Chicago or not. Or even whether you resent Chicago. So at any rate, that's kind of what I want to do. I want to dig into that question. And I just want to start by getting you guys to think about the first thing I would say is that consider that teachers as a group or as individuals aren't very powerful in our society. It's not a C-suite job. Teachers don't make a lot of money if you compare how much education they have to, say, someone with the same amount of education, say, an accountant. Would make more money with about the same level of training. Teaching, it seems, women's work with kids. It's often very disrespected in our society, and there's plenty of places where people who work in the education world, even teachers, professors at community colleges, can't afford to live in the communities where those schools are located. So if you're in San Francisco, you can't live in San Francisco on a teacher's salary. Many of the North Shore suburbs, that's true as well. Less so in Chicago, although it's not so easy in Chicago either. So how then do teachers become powerful? And I just would I'll start this by saying that teachers didn't set out, in my experience, to change the system. What happened is that we became aware of the degree to which the system started screwing us. We had to find a way to respond. And working in public schools is difficult, and it's difficult now, but 25 years ago it was even more difficult. And just to give you a sense, I mean, I talk about this in three ways. Chicago has a deep legacy of racial segregation, in which, you know, there are sets of neighborhoods, especially in the north or southwest sides of the city, where with relatively good school resources and school environments were conducive to a high-quality education, but then big parts of the city that were fairly starved systematically of resources. Have people heard of Benjamin Willis? Do you know this character? In Chicago, black migration really starts happening in larger numbers into the city after World War II, you know, accelerating in the 50s into the early 60s. And there's a superintendent of the schools who was known as being a big school builder, but he refused to build schools in black neighborhoods of the city. So you have large numbers of people moving into the city and a superintendent who won't build schools there. Builds lots of schools. He's known as a school builder, but mainly in white neighborhoods. In black neighborhoods, what he does is he puts these mobile units, these trailers, which he comes in and puts on the school's parking lots and makes schools in the south that makes students attend schools in two shifts. There's a racial segregation system. There's more to that that I could say. Schools that, where black teachers, for example, are made to take a literacy test similar to the kind of poll test that they had in the South, and the literacy test is oral, and if the person who's giving the test doesn't like the way you sound, you fail. And so black teachers in the city of Chicago weren't, even though they had all the state certifications necessary to be teachers, weren't allowed to be full teachers with full pay and all the benefits of teaching. They were considered full-time basis substitutes. So like that, you know, racial segregation in Chicago has a very real set of impacts and the legacy of that. Second thing is a legacy of financial crisis and the starvation of funds. In the early 1980s, the school finances in Chicago were taken over by the state. There's a school finance authority. And it meant that there were a lot of schools that didn't have basic supplies. When I started teaching in the late 90s, a lot of teachers would keep a roll of toilet paper because there was so rarely toilet paper in the bathroom that when students had to go to the bathroom, they would check out your roll of toilet paper. They would take it, they'd take it to the bathroom, and when they came back, they'd give it back to you. You know, things like that. Lack of, you know, books that were decades old. We're talking about crumbling facades of buildings, broken heat in the winter, no air conditioning in the summer. Most CPS buildings weren't air conditioned. When I started teaching at Chicago Vocational in the late 90s, there was a metal shop teacher who told me that his budget was a couple $100s. And I said, well, metal is expensive. How do you teach metalworking for the couple $100s per student? And he said, no, not a couple $100s per student. I have a couple $100s for my entire budget to teach metalworking to 150 students. So what he would do is he would do fundraising with the students early in the year. They didn't start working with metal. He would spend the $200 on photocopies. They would fundraise to buy a piece of metal. They would fold into things. These people like do ductwork, HVAC. This is valuable work, right? If you have an HVAC degree, you can make a good living at that. And then after they were done building something, they would hammer it out, and they would build something again. And over the course of the year, the projects had to get smaller because the metal would break and degrade and whatnot. But so he's like building little metal birdhouses with students who he's supposed to be teaching about doing HVAC ductwork, but can't do the work. So this was just kind of typical, a real financial crisis in the system. And then the third thing is I'd say there's an ideological crisis in the schools. That is, the idea about what our schools were supposed to be for is undergoing a profound shift. When I was young, politicians were really worried about competitors. Back then it was Germany, Japan, then increasingly Asia, China, Hong Kong, etc. The idea that our lack of educational attainment was hurting our economic competitiveness. And Reagan, Clinton, and then the second Bush all had some version of a plan. The Bush's plan was called No Child Left Behind. People might have heard of that. But basically the idea was that there would be improvements towards a standard of what a highly educated student was supposed to be. And if schools didn't make those cuts, there would be punishments and consequences for the schools. Schools could be closed, teachers could lose their jobs over that, etc. And how would it be measured? It would be measured through test scores. So if you ever wonder why there were so many tests in your life, you know, everyone loves taking standardized tests, it's very much related to the national politics of education. And the problem with tests, of course, among other there's a couple problems, one of which is that the best predictor of student test scores is the income of your parents. That's the single best predictor. You know, how many Volvos are in the parking lot of the school is going to give you a better idea of what the test scores of the school are going to be than how skilled your English teacher is. And then the other problem with it is that there's all kinds of perverse incentives. People try to narrow the curriculum, focus just on test prep. And of course, that's boring. The thing that actually makes students better is time on task with relevant instruction. That is, you have an instructor that excites you. You know, you get into the subject, you spend time with it. You know, you've got relevant instruction that's challenging, and that's what actually makes you better at a subject. But there's a very weird way in which the test prep narrows the curriculum and makes school more boring, and then, by the way, also punishes schools. And so all these things together produced, you know, a very acute crisis for people who had gone into teaching. A lot of us had gone into teaching because we wanted to make the world better. We wanted to reach students. You know, there was a lot of talk about making the world, you know, about the importance of education. A bunch of us took that at face value. And then you get in the schools and you just discover that they're deeply segregated, they're starved of funds, and there's an ideological crisis in which your education is being narrowed down to testing. So that sort of sets the scene about why educators like me decide to try to do something about that. Now, this raises the question: if you're a teacher, how do you do something about it? You know, school systems are big bureaucracies. It's not like you can just, you know, go to your school board meeting and speak out. We tried that. I spent a lot of time in my life going to school board meetings and saying there's a problem the way things run. But we had this idea that one of the institutions that was really going to be important and was going to open up our ability to change things was our union. And I'm not sure how, I'm not, like the people here, how familiar are you guys with unions? A little bit, yeah. Some, okay. Basic idea is simple, that as an individual, you know, if you ask your boss to change, they can say, well, if you don't like it, leave, which means you have no power at all, other than quitting. But that as a group, you can make demands of your boss, and because the boss depends on you to do all the work, the boss has to respond to your demands in some way. And it's, the current law in our country requires a thing called collective bargaining, requires that the boss actually negotiate with groups of workers. But you don't need that law. I mean, the earliest recorded instance of a strike in world history, it was written down, was in ancient Egypt, where slaves who were building some monumental project refused to do the work. So, you know, strikes are more than 2,000 years old in the written record. I'm sure they're really as old as work, because people didn't even have a modern conception of rights at that point. But you don't need to have a conception to know that, like, if you're doing work and you stop doing it, that gives you bargaining power, right? That's the basic idea of it. So that's very broad, but particularly the way unions exist now have multiple legacies. And it's just worth pointing out that there is an idea about unions that see unions as sort of being at the forefront of fighting for human dignity. And we're talking about, you know, during the early factory era, the unions that fought, you know, that organized women textile workers, and, you know, fought against child labor, fought for, you know, shortening the workday from 12 hours down to 8 so that people have time to do something other than work, producing weekends, fighting for health care. Unions that were the forefront of civil rights struggles. That is, you know, there's the unions in which there was a broad conception of the organization fighting to improve the lives of all workers. Right? Alternately, that's not the only conception of unions there is. There's a different legacy as well. Unions can also be more like guilds, in which a union tries to preside over a closed labor market and tries to keep people out of it, if people coming in would undercut the wages of the people who are already in. So there's a big history of segregated labor unions, whites-only labor unions. And then even unions that weren't overtly racist could be very conservative, interested in the administration of workplace rules, not trying to change workplace exploitation, not trying to get rid of workplace exploitation, but very interested in bargaining the exact limits of it. Filing complaints, legalistic processes, a narrow outlook about wages and benefits for the people who already work, you know, who are already members of the union. So, you know, two very different conceptions. And in Chicago, we had a union that was very much, people call that idea of unions, where it's very narrow, a conservative idea of union, a business union, a union that runs like a business. It's in the business of representing members. People call the other kind of union, one that has a broad conception about fighting to improve the lives of all workers, people call that social justice unionism. Sometimes it's called class struggle unionism. People use those terms. We wanted to have a social justice union, but what we had was a business union. And so a small group of us decided to change something. And I will just, you know, for the sake of time, I'll say that there are sort of three key dynamics about the process by which we decided to change our union. One was we made a decision to organize ourselves, and there was a number of things that we did as teachers. None of us had any full-time jobs, or any of us had any full-time job as organizers. We all full-time classroom teachers, and but we would, like I said before, we'd go to public hearings and speak out. We would meet and share ideas. We formed a reading circle. We read a book by this woman, an author named Naomi Klein, called The Shock Doctrine, which we thought described some of what was going on across the country in terms of the attack on public schools. And we eventually formed a caucus. A caucus is a group within a group, right? So that we're all members of a union. That was our primary organization. But then we formed a group within that union, and we called it the Caucus of Rank and File Educators. Second thing that was like a key important organizing idea for us is that we thought that unions would be would unlock their power and potential if they were more democratic. That is to say, if the union is run by a small group of people along business principles, that is leaving lots of power and lots of ideas daring off the table. We want to have a union be democratic. We want it to involve lots of people. We want it to speak out. And there's a whole number of ways in which we did that. We did eventually wind up taking over the union, and so rather than just having a couple of people go bargain contracts, we brought a whole bunch of members into those rooms. We shared that information out widely. We involved the regular people in the work that union did. We said that all the key jobs in the union should be done by teachers. You know, maybe you don't have a teacher who's a communication specialist, so you have to hire occasionally outside. But for the most part, the work of representing workers should be done by the workers themselves. You know, so that was an important idea that we had. We should have open debates. You know, our union shouldn't be afraid of having ideas that go back and forth. Democratic, open, participatory, that was the sort of the second organizing idea that we had. And I would argue that's an important idea if you ever get into a place where you want to organize some social movements. That's important. And then the third thing that I would say is we didn't shy away from confrontation. We thought that we were going to have some fights, that we didn't think that we had enough forces to win, but that we didn't then conclude that therefore we shouldn't fight. We concluded that therefore we should try to build more power. And that basic idea that what our union was going to do was going to try to be powerful, it was going to try to win. And in situations where we were like, yeah, I don't think we can win, the answer wasn't to run away and to make ideological justifications for why we should duck fights. It was to figure out how to get more power, how to become more effective, how to get more allies, how to get more people in the room, how to broaden our reach. So through a set of circumstances which go beyond the scope of this talk, We wound up winning an election to run the union. So the Chicago Teachers Union in the middle of 2010, there's an election with a caucus of rank and file educators, a group of ragtag people who'd never run any union at all, wind up running the largest local in the state. So like that happens in 2010. And then not too long on the heels of that, Mayor Richard Daley announces that he's not running for re-election, and the person who comes striding into office is Rahm Emanuel. Now, Rahm Emanuel was the mayor of the city of Chicago for 8 years from 2011 through to 2019. But he wasn't just some dude. Rahm Emanuel was the former, he had been at Congress. He was big deal in National Democratic Party politics. He had been both Clinton and Obama's White House chief of staff. So this is a person who's deeply connected to national politics. He's an A-team politician, if you will. And he starts off rapidly to orchestrate a series of attacks on teachers and very profound changes, to the way schools operate. So one thing, just to say a couple things about that quickly, Rahm Emanuel starts being very aware there's a financial cliff, it's called a fiscal cliff, a structural deficit that exists in the schools, even more profound than we'd had before. So he's looking at $1 billion-a-year deficit, and what does he decide to do? When there's $1 billion deficit in your household budget, or a deficit in your household budget, you cut costs, right? Not wrong, he decides that he's going to increase school by 20%. So he's going to lengthen both the length of the time in the day, and he's going to lengthen the amount of time in the year, and he's going to add a whole bunch of new programs. So that means, so imagine it, like you're working and now you're being told you have to work 20% more, but by the way, there's no money, so you're going to have to do that all for actually a pay cut. That didn't go over very well. And the other thing he tries to do is he tries to impose a series of labor reforms, the biggest of which was directly tying our performance ratings to student test scores, and then tying those ratings to whether or not you kept your job. So student test scores determine your rating, and your rating determines whether you're fired. So teachers were obviously worried about that because, we don't have as much control over student test scores as we would like. Especially if you're teaching in a school that has crappy test scores. At any rate, we saw that coming. Partly because Rahm said it, partly because this was our outlook to begin with. And so what we did is, in terms of don't back off from confrontations, we spent our time trying to build and strengthen alliances with community organizations, parent organizations. That involved going out and meeting with folks. That involved incorporating their key issues into our bargaining demands. So, our union actually spent a bunch of time building an alliance with community and parents, so that when we had a strike in 2012, we had massive community support. In fact, 2/3 of parents supported the strike a week into it. And, teacher strikes suck for parents. I'm a parent. You have to scramble to find arrangements for your kids. They're not in school. You want them in school. I don't buy the panic about it. That people say, you're endangering children. Do we endanger children every summer break? Do we endanger children every winter break? I think that's overblown. I think that parents understand. They don't like it, but they understand that if the strike is for a set of demands about getting resources to their school and has a chance of actually improving the school for their children, they're willing to put up with some disruption in their life in order to get that. It's when they think the two sides are behaving like children and the disruption to their kids' education is pointless and there's no end in sight, that's when parents start to get pissed off, right? And fair enough, by the way. But these were fights over real school issues. At any rate, the strike in 12 gets resolved, and Rahm Emanuel promptly after the end of the strike, rather than trying to seek some accommodation, with our union, decides that he's going to double down with a massive school closing program. And I believe the school closing program in Chicago was done in order to save money. I think they looked at there's the loss of population in certain Chicago neighborhoods. But at any rate, he originally proposed to close 120 schools. They wound up closing 50. Not 120, but they were overwhelmingly in black neighborhoods, and it produced a tremendous amount of resentment. No one wants to see the schools your kid goes to get closed down. For one, it feels like you're closing down the prospect of your neighborhood ever improving. Who wants to live in a neighborhood where they move to a neighborhood where there's no schools for your kids? Also, for the people whose schools had to move, that was very disruptive and went poorly. A lot of violence, a lot of displacement, a lot of loss of learning there. And it produced a two things. And politically, that produced a reinvigorated call for an elected school board in Chicago, because the board that voted that was an appointed school board. And the other thing it produced was a call for Rahm to get booted out of office. Right? One-term mayor, people went around shouting. If you're you and me and you're on a demonstration against your school being closed and you start chanting one-term mayor, that means you don't intend to vote for him. But if you're a citywide organization like the teachers and you actually have a budget and staff and whatnot, and you say one-term mayor, you feel some obligation to actually run someone or see if there's someone who's going to run who can really win. So what happened is that the teachers' union, which had always been an organization which kind of like was pretty nervous about being directly involved in politics, and I know that sounds, it might sound funny for you guys to hear me say, but there was a bunch of hazards from the point of view of a union to being involved in politics. One is that politics is expensive and you lose as much as you often lose. The other one is that unions represent all the workers at a workplace. That's the definition of how unions work, or all are damn close, as close to all as you can get. Politics in this country, on the other hand, is very divisive. In fact, the two parties resemble each other a lot, have a lot of really commonly shared policies. Maybe less so now, politics is more polarized than it's been. But historically, two parties very close, and they have only a couple of issues that differentiate them. And they try to make those issues as close to 50-50 so they've got a chance of winning. Like, in other words, like the political parties tailor their message to see if they can split off just enough people to win. Meaning that both parties are pretty close to 50-50. So if you're a union and you start taking political positions, you run the risk of splitting your own membership down the middle, which is risky. And we didn't really want to do that risk. But we felt like we didn't have a choice. And we didn't have a choice because things kept happening to us which were controlled politically. And I'm not going to get to go through all of them in lots of detail again, because I want to leave some time at the end for questions. But there were a series of political decisions that were happening in Chicago at that time which really had very negative impact on the schools, a lot of which had to do with an ongoing financial crisis. The decision to close schools, for financial reasons. A school administration that rewrote the rules about how students could get special education status in order to save money on special education. You say, wait a second, I thought if a group of educators thought that a student had special needs, that was a federal legal process which ensured that student would get the educational support that they deserve. Well, it is, but what if a teacher has to fill out 100 pages of paperwork in order to get that designation? Well, 100 is an exaggeration, but literally there's a 28-page form that they asked us to fill out. So guess what happened? The Board of Education hired a consultant, paid good money to the Boston Consulting Group to rewrite the rules for getting special education services, and in a way that was going to decrease the number of special education students and save the district $30 million a year. And a whole number of other, big hiring freeze, so that they increased the length of the school day by quite a lot, and then suddenly they stopped hiring, so that our schools were critically understaffed. series of crises roll out along these lines. The union feels like it has no real option except to run for office. Our president starts talking about running for mayor, gets brain cancer, unfortunately, and isn't able to run. And the CTU winds up supporting someone else, this guy Chuy Garcia, who loses to the mayor. But the union then is like there's some barrier has been broken, the steel has been broken. Our union is now more involved in mayoral politics after that point. The living through the crisis, there was a profound financial crisis in which I really thought the schools were going to go bankrupt. And I don't really even know what, imagine the schools going bankrupt. I don't even really know what that means. It means you don't honor your contracts. You don't honor your contracts with teachers. You don't honor your contracts with vendors. Like, how do you get credit to do all the things that schools have to do? Schools collect property taxes twice a year. But in between when those property tax payments come in, they have to borrow money in order to make payroll. If you're bankrupt and you don't have credit, how do you even do that? Like I literally was convinced the schools were going bankrupt in the city of Chicago in the period of time during Rahm's second run. They came up with a bunch of tricks that I accountants can get very tricky. So for example, one year they did a 14-month fiscal year. So they could, property taxes come in August, so they could collect the August property taxes twice in one year. I was like, oh, that's creative. I wonder if I could do that for my federal taxes. You can't, by the way, you're not allowed to do that. But, I was like, let them do that one twice. They couldn't. Then the next year they spent the reserves. So they completely zeroed out their reserves, meaning they had to they did a whole series of really risky bond trades, which actually they lost hundreds of millions of dollars on. And then finally, they went to they did really risky high interest rate borrowing at the very end, in which they had a series of bonds that were due they couldn't pay, and so they went to either Zion Bank in Utah and got a loan for 450 basis points worse than the prime rate that you could have gotten if they were a good creditor. So some investor made a ton of money off that. That's an unheard of interest rate penalty. It's like 2.5 times, it's like adding 2.5 times the cost of your house on your mortgage. But they did that in order to make a payment. And then in the end, they actually were able to get through, despite the fact that Rauner was the governor, they were able to get through a financial package which funded the schools. An increase in taxes in order to pay some of the school's financial obligations. So, how does that then lead to the CTU electing someone? Well, the CTU is during that period of time, is in a constant fight. We feel like a fight for our survival. We never reach sort of an accommodation with the Democratic mayor or with the sort of the political establishment in the city. We're constantly in combat and fights. We continue as a union to orient on social movements. There is a there's, for example, a shooting of an unarmed teenager, or I guess he had a knife, but didn't have a gun, and he's shot in the back by Chicago cops, called Laquan McDonald. People would have heard of this. It happened before the mayoral election in early 15, happened actually in late 14, but the word of it didn't come out until 14 months later or so, and that caused a big scandal, and our union sided with our students in the communities they were outraged by that instead of siding with the government and the police and whatnot. So we continue to take an oppositional stance. The other thing we did is we decided to reorganize our own political party, this thing called the UWF, in which, rather than simply all the effort and fundraising and door knocking and all the information from that going to the local Democratic Party, we decided we were going to try to own and control that ourselves. We adopted a strategy where rather than simply running in every election, we are going to try to pick candidates very carefully that really championed our issues. So rather than endorsing in 100 different races, we would endorse in 4 or 5 races and only pick people who really were We're fighting hard on things that we thought needed to be fought hard on. This produced, over time, a small section of candidates who we thought were really were champions, and a kind of an a political ecosystem which we helped us develop our own political organization, some confidence, some understanding about how electoral politics worked, and et cetera. Rahm Emanuel decides he's not going to run for re-election in 2019, and he's replaced by Lori Lightfoot. Lori Lightfoot's administration is kind of a disaster. The city winds up being up for grabs in a whole series of ways. And the union decides to run, so when her term is up, the union decides to run had been a middle school and elementary school teacher, this guy Brandon Johnson. He taught at Jenner Academy, which is right in Cabrini Green in Chicago. And he and I had actually hired him as an organizer in 2011 as the union is starting to think about how we're going to transform our union to become a more educational justice-oriented union. So that's Brandon Johnson's background, and we won the election, which in some ways like is the culmination of a long political journey, but it's not really the ultimate culmination because there's still a lot of ways in which you don't have educational justice in the city of Chicago. And it turns out that just occupying an office isn't the same as being able to set all the terms in the agenda in a political city the size of Chicago. There's lots of other constituencies that are still there, but it gives us flavor for how we proceeded and what we did. So I want to make sure that we've got some time. We've got about 10 minutes. I want to stop talking, and if you folks have questions or comments, now would be a good chance to do that. But do use the mic because this is being webcast, and that way it picks up your voice.
What does the UWF stand for?
Oh, thank you. Essentially, United Working Families. It was an attempt to build a political organization that could essentially function like a political party, and promote the platform and ideas that our union was involved in.
Thank you.
Right on.
Other questions?
Hello. And my question is, now that it's a political party, is there any mechanism for preventing it to become a, how can I say the word, corrupt political party?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll say this, that, you know, I'm not sure the word corrupt is even necessary there. But it's to say, like, there's a way in which the normal functioning of politics produces a series of accommodations with the system, the way the system works. And, you know, for example, a lot of businesses in Chicago, the people who, you know, who own the real estate, who hire employees, who, you know, make the contracts to make commerce go, that is very, very important folks. They care about keeping their taxes low, they care about safe streets, and they care about, economic development. I'm not sure where that necessarily leaves great quality schools, access to decent housing, any one of another social issues. So you don't really need to even be corrupt in order to accommodate to the way the political system works. My personal opinion about this is that the same force which CORE looked to, the caucus that we are part of, looked to kind of make our union democratic and effective, rank and file activism, is the same force that needs to be brought to play, you know, in political organization. Because unions can't say, oh, well, we elected our guy, now all is good, now we're just going to go back to operating the way normal politics works. We're going to have to continue to have activist campaigns. In other words, we can't simply accommodate to the system now that we happen to have our guy in office, if that makes any sense.
Hi. So I have a couple questions, but when you began talking and you say, you know, all of you formed together in order to create this union and so forth, where are the students now? So we have, you know, Johnson in order or as the mayor. What about those same concerns? So you have the 504s or 28 pages, you know, of teachers having to do this work in order to get special needs students the services that they need. So now we have a teacher in place. We still have some of these historic problems that are taking place. And so then I say, you know, how is that trickle down to the teachers? How are the teachers benefiting? But most importantly, as a teacher, former CPS teacher, you know, I want to see the students succeed. And so with those barriers by administration, fiscally, all of these other things, you know, as an outsider who lives in Chicago, who sees this, I still see the problems of these students. Mm-hmm. And how do you as a union address this? Now we got, you know, Johnson up there, but, you know, as you said, it's not only education that he has to focus on. Mm-hmm. He's running a major city. So the bottom line for a person like myself who doesn't have kids, but I pay my taxes because I believe in education, I want students to succeed. They're the next members of society who are going to take me to where I need to be. But if teachers still have to do 28 pages or they can't get the funding or they can't do this, so what are your steps? I mean, that's a big loaded question.
Let me say something. The short answer is that some things have improved. So for example, the CPS's special education restriction was found illegal by the state. They got put under a state takeover, and there's been some improvements there. The IEP process is still a long process. You know, that's an ongoing fight. But, you know, I can say that the severe rationing of special education is going on, has been reduced. Like, we actually have better access to services in that regard. And there's been some other things that we've done okay at as well. So, for example, in the last contract, one of the big issues had to do with the fact that most CPS schools didn't have a school nurse most days of the week. You know, you would have a nurse on Tuesday. But if you got sick on Wednesday or you broke your leg on a Thursday, you know, there wasn't going to be someone there in your school. And CPS has agreed in writing to, and in fact, to have clinicians in schools now every day of the week. So, like, you know, so again, there's been improvements there. That said, there's still problems. You know, take, for example, the question of violence, which I know a lot of people think a lot of. My own son goes to a neighborhood high school in Chicago, and last week there was a fatal shooting at his school. And, you know, he was just up the block when it happened. We're just on the same street, a block and a half away. So, you know, that's a bigger set of social issues, right? I mean, this is not just Chicago. This is has to do with a bunch of internested issues that we have to work on. And so having meaningful violence prevention, you know, which should be tied to students not being so hopeless, you know, in the neighborhoods, that's a bigger program. And one that I really strongly believe that the labor movement is at its best when it's proposing solutions and thinking about how things can be better and not simply trying to just say, okay, we're with this guy. Because, you know, Brandon Johnson comes out of our union, but it doesn't mean that he's immune from all the pressures of the way a system works. It really doesn't.
Hi. Could you tell us about the creation of CORE, that caucus, and what was your strategy for persuading members within the union to, you know, change from the administration, the current administration at the time, the leadership, and support you? Like, how did you go about doing it without causing too much animosity within the union? And
yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the first thing I'll say is that CORE really was a rank and file operation. That is, we spent a lot of time doing the kinds of things that teachers like to do. I mean, we were a bit nerds, so we had a book group, you know. A bunch of things that people would recognize if you've ever been involved in activism. We would have flyers for meetings, and we'd get to try to distribute those flyers among people who might want to come. We kept a listserv that shared interesting articles, or you know, where people made announcements about events that were going on. We did a lot of kind of grassroots organization building. The heart of our philosophy, though, is that we wanted to demonstrate what an effective union could be like. And that we didn't aim our fire at people who were in the union but had the wrong idea of the union. They weren't our enemy. They were just people who had a different idea of how the union should operate. So it was something like we wouldn't go out and, you know, attack the administration of our own union. We would try to demonstrate what an activist union should really be like by, you know, we'd go out and we'd have pickets at the Board of Ed, or we would go, we'd find a corporation that was having a, got a huge tax break, and we would pass that information about how huge their tax break was and how much education programming you could fund if that Cadillac dealership hadn't gotten $8 million of TIF funds, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so it's partly we tried to lead by example. And then we recruited. We made a conscious, you know, attempt to keep track of who came to our events, call them up, invite them to meetings, involve them in the thinking. And I would say that when we won office, we probably had about 30 really good activists, and maybe in a wider periphery of maybe 100 or 150 people. But like, you can do a lot with 30 really good activists. And, you know, those 30 activists, that's how we did it. With organization, with some ideas, and then importantly, by not being sectarian, by not, like, trying to attack people who we had a lot in common with, but tried to figure out what our common interests were and try to lead and try to be something of an inspiration.
Thank you.
I know we don't have much time, so I know you can't answer this in a short amount of time, but the topic of selective enrollment and so you mentioned neighborhood schools and ROM closing those 50 and wanting this in this, you know, I having people not have access to a neighborhood school, and then having people go through the selective enrollment process, and sometimes traveling, my office mate lives, you know, in Mount Greenwood. Her kid goes to Lane Tech. Because, of course, I said, yeah, go to Lane Tech. I drive every day from Lane Tech. Exactly. Where was she going to go, you know, within her own area? So she's on the wait list for March 22nd. Maybe Jones, she can transfer in, because that's a less, you know, long, you know, trip from Mount Greenwood up to Lane Tech, if anyone knows. It's a trip.
For the sake of time, let me I can't do much more than point you in a direction, because I want to respect your time, and if there's people who want to talk more, I can, I'm happy to hang out after. But I would say that, like, our vision of this is that everyone should have a great school they want to go to actually in their neighborhood. That's the way it works in the suburbs. You don't hear people in the suburbs saying, oh, you know, I want to have four different schools to choose from. If, you know, if you go to New Trier, you're happy to go to New Trier. If you go to Evanston Township High School, you're happy to go to that. There's a lot of really great high schools in the state of Illinois that don't require lotteries and special applications and a whole set of things that happens in CPS. What school choice in CPS is about, it's about rationing education. It means there's some small number of schools that you apply to get into that are well-resourced, that have, you know, really challenging classes, that have lots of good students at them, and they pull from around, and then those students and resources don't go to the local school. I don't think that's something we can change like that. I mean, the system exists, you know, and I'm trying to kick people out of their schools. Obviously, parents have a right to choose. If you're a parent who's unhappy with your school, by all means, don't send your kid to that school. That's your child, for God's sakes, right? But, you know, it would be great if the schools could get it together to provide a really good school that people want to go to that's their local school. So thank you guys all very much. I appreciate the chance to chat.
Thank you all.
I know. I kind of heard you moan when I asked him. You knew I would. I mean, geez. All right.